If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Big Ben Strong is on the board. Wild Willers getting booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
Good afternoon. It's 900 CHML. I'm Scott Thompson, Hamilton Today. Welcome to the fun. Big Ben spinning the Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. Little Children is the song. Here is some rock and roll history. On this day in 1964, and you might remember what happened during the early 1960s. They called it the British Revolution, the English Revolution, British Invasion. Thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. And oddly enough, because of course, when the Beatles hit, the traditionalists, Buddy Holly's, and well, he passed away, Chuck Berry's, that sort of thing, it shifted. And all of a sudden, there were all of these acts on the US charts from Britain. The British Invasion. Oddly enough, in the 1980s, there were more songs on the U.S. charts, North American charts, in the 1980s from the U.K. than there were in the 1960s. So, spin that around. For the first time in history of the U.K. charts, on this day in 1964, there were no American acts in the top 10. So the British Invasion also invading Britain. Acts like the Rolling Stones take hold in their home country as well. The British have not only invaded America at home, the top 10 UK, once filled with the Brenda Lees, the Four Seasons, the Chuck Berry's, now loaded with local talent. 9 of the entries in the top 10 are English, and 1 is Irish. Oddly enough, on this week in 1964, this would change by April. No songs in the top 10 by the Beatles. But by later, I think the next couple of months, they will at one point occupy all 5 positions in top 5 billboards. All right, so same thing happening in the UK. So Little Children, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas coming in at number 3. Also going to touch on some other ones who are also in the top 10 in the UK on this day in 1964. Was that a long way to go for that? Did I make it more confusing for you? Anyway, there you go. All right, feel free to jump into the fun. Love to hear from you. Send us a note, Scott Thompson at 900CHML.com. Phone lines are always open. Talk, text, leave us your last word. We would love to hear from you. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why this sort of fact stood out for me today was I can't believe all the attention that the picture of the royal family is getting, because it has been edited by Kate, I guess. And apparently in one of the shots on like her left hand, she's got like 10 fingers. Huh? 8. She's got 8 fingers. Huh? Okay, never mind. So, again, you know, and I get it, there's royal watches out there, and we're going to have Alyssa Freeman, who's probably the biggest royal watcher we know, comment on this a little later on this hour. I was totally astonished to see this as the lead story in the CTV National News last night. The lead story, considering what is going on in the world, the lead story on the CTV National News was about the royal picture. Is it me? I don't know. Anyway, we'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, you know, the plane that dropped 150 meters, to me, that's a little bit more than the royal picture, but just saying, imagine that being in a plane and it plummets 150 meters. Guess what? Keep the seatbelts on. There's the lesson of the day, because the person that was sitting next to you that didn't is on the roof right now with their laptop in their head. So, incredibly, very little injury, but wow, what an incredible story. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, the CBC giving out almost $15 million in bonuses. What the heck is with that? And they're complaining that they're underfunded. Unbelievable when you think that people are being fired and the state of things and such, that $15 million of taxpayers' money is being handed out in bonuses for the CBC this past calendar year. 63% of Canadians are tired of the spending. They want the government to get the spending under control. 63%, that's two-thirds, and that's courtesy of Nanos. And another local story that we're following, and we're going to end with this, but before we get to that, the running message is like they're going to sell off the LCBO. Has anybody heard of that? Has anybody ever heard? But I guess selling off the LCBO is allowing you to buy it in other stores. So there's no loss of revenue. There's no loss of taxes. There's no loss of any of that. It's just it's in more outlets. But somehow that is selling off the LCBO. Is it 2024? Is it really? Or is it still 1964? Where we fill out a pad of paper and hand it to the guy behind the counter wearing the glasses and the tie. So anyway, I haven't heard anything about anybody selling off any part of the LCBO, but apparently that's what the unions are saying when they're putting booze into Walmarts or other stores, which I kind of find a bit of a stretch. All right. And the great news, $73 million in economic activity. That's between Hamilton and Niagara over the course of, the Grey Cup weekend, which is great. And that's like $30 million for, Hamilton alone and, $250,000 people visiting over the course of the festival, 35,000 of those from out of town. So, kudos to everybody in the Hammer for, once again, putting on a great show that, clearly people love to come to this city and partay. And there was lots of great stuff going on, if you can remember, when they incorporated Supercrawl and all of that stuff and the organizers of to be a part of this, adding a lot more entertainment and sporting installations to really make it a festival. More than just the game, but everything else that was going on. So kudos to everybody in Hamilton who helped with the big show. And it certainly paid off for Hamiltonians, which is great to see. All right. It is 3:15 and a long show. Don't forget, we've got Hammerhead Trivia coming up after the 5 o'clock news and your chance to win. We've got, this is a cool show coming to the First Ontario Center, Queen. It's a Kind of Magic. First Ontario Concert Hall. That's April 21st. We've got your tickets for that coming up after the 5 o'clock news when we play another edition of Hammerhead Trivia. Nick Nanos is going to be joining us over the course of the show and Keith Mackey from Mackey International in regard to that airline incident. There's a couple of stories actually going out there. One involving a baby being born in mid-flight. What happens then? And then, of course, the issue with the turbulence. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, going to talk about the royal picture. It's all on the way. 3:50. I was hoping we couldn't. We wouldn't have to, but we're going to get to it. Just ask why. Okay, so I've been sort of vaguely following the story about Kate Middleton and the picture of her hand. She's got like 12 fingers on one hand, and I think one of them is actually a monkey finger or something like that. Huh? Okay, so it's not that bad. But there, you know, some sort of hocus pocus editing has been going on, and people just seem to be up in arms about this, and I get it. It's the royal family, and there's people like our good friend Alyssa Freeman, PR pop culture expert, who just loves the royals, and that's why we're having her on right now. But I was very surprised at 11 o'clock that this was a lead story on the CTV News. The lead story, considering what's going on in the world. But maybe we just need a break. Alyssa Freeman with us, PR pop culture expert, Alyssa P. She's here. How are you, Alyssa?
Oh, I'm so fine, Scott. So glad you asked me to comment on the story. And actually, the lead-in piece of music I wanted, you didn't quite get to the chorus, but it was Kodachrome.
Yes.
By Paul Simon. And I thought, how apropos, at least Scott will like it.
Yes. Yeah. Paul Simon, Kodachrome. Absolutely. And I was going to mention that because Ben mentioned that in my ear, but I thought, you know, that's getting too personal. Anyway, so now, although we're getting personal because this is about your love for the Royals, not about a hand. I'm just kidding. So you know,
go ahead.
Tell me the story. What happened? What's the hullabaloo about?
Well, let's back up a bit, Scott, because nobody has really seen Kate Middleton, not hide nor hair, since Christmas. And then we hear that she has gone in for abdominal surgery and will not resume her duties until after Easter. So the royals gave a very, very long, wide timeline that, listen, she's recovering. Nobody knew what type of surgery it was. It was the same time when Charles announced that he had prostate cancer. So, you know, there was a lot of speculation about what is going on at Buckingham Palace. Then, for some reason, I can't even say for some reason, Scott, because this seems to happen organically now, the conspiracy rumor mill starts. And where is Kate? Is she dead? Is there a double? Is it about a bad haircut gone awry? Has she had some sort of facelift? What has been going on? So it has been just rampant. And in fact, you know, whenever I go into Twitter/X, the one thing I do is I always look in the search and I see who's leading, like who, what are people looking up? And Kate Middleton has been top of mind, top of searches for ages now. So finally, to try and dispel all these conspiracy theories, they say, okay, last Sunday in the UK, it was Mother's Day. Let's put out a photo. And we know that if you follow the royals, they tend to do their own photography. So they put out a really nice Mother's Day photo. I saw it in my feed and I'm like, oh, isn't that nice? Scroll. Well, you know, you can't just put out a photo these days, Scott, without people going into a frenzy on, is this a real photo or is this a Photoshop photo? And as soon as people discovered through small discrepancies where patterns were not matching up, that they found it was a Photoshop photo, and everything that the royals were trying to dispel by coming out with a photo of Kate live and in person has actually backfired and has vaulted the story out of the annals of social media and conspiracy theorists and to, as you say, the top story on the 11 o'clock news.
So I guess what's the conspiracy theory here, that if they've altered the picture in any way, and it was simplistic little things to alter it, that it may not even be her. The whole thing could be a fake. Is that the conspiracy theory?
Yeah, that's the long game. That's the long game on this. And the fact that we're even having this conversation, listen, Scott, I do like the royals. I wouldn't say that I'm in love with the royals, but I find the whole mystique around them to be extremely compelling. So, you know, when you do read the comments, half of the comments are, there's something funny going on at the palace. And the other half of the comments are, she took a picture. She Photoshopped it. Anybody ever done that? Oh, well, move on along. And in fact, Adobe, who owns Photoshop, their stock went up yesterday as a result when people found out that Kate Middleton had an Adobe subscription.
How do you explain that?
I don't know, especially since you didn't do a very good job on it. So I have no explanation for that. But, you know, let's concentrate now on the palace's PR machine. This is not the first day at the rodeo for them. We know that they have been manipulating and held a very, very tight shop around all their public relations and how the messaging goes out. So it seems that I don't know who is running the shop right now at Buckingham Palace. And I know that each family sort of has their own PR person. But honestly, they have to really gather ranks and get everybody on the same page, because the things that they thought were working are not working. The things that they're trying to do to dispel rumors are only fueling the rumors. So it seems that they're not really having a great practice of PR there. And instead, what they're trying to do is please the masses. And when you try to please somebody and take that out of what your overall communications plan is, you know, everything has 20% failure attached to it. But this really, really went out of whack. And what the palace should do is just stick to the knitting, stick to what they do, stick to not necessarily answering everything. Because often they don't, Scott, often they don't. They might put out they probably did put out a statement that said, listen, we told you she'd be back after Easter. It's a few short weeks away. We look forward to Kate's full recovery. See you then with the Easter Bunny. And that's what they should have done.
So why not just have a quick little shot of her running from the car to the palace or whatever and waving with the kids? See, look, she's fine. Like, why not just do that and, you know, put all this to bed?
Well, you know, I think they thought they could do that, but then it starts to fuel more speculation about why they didn't. So instead, what they did, Scott, is that they put her in a car with William. He went somewhere and then she had another appointment. So it was almost like it was supposed to be spontaneous. It wasn't supposed to be more much of a photo call, although I'm sure they phoned up all the papers and said, we're going to be at this street, at this corner, at this time, so get your shot while you can. But instead, they sort of kept her sequestered in a car. So yeah, they could see that it was kind of her. I don't think it dispelled any rumors for conspiracy theorists as much as the palace cares about conspiracy theorists. But all it did was fuel some more. So why don't they do it? I don't know. I think that the palace has a very sort of wonky policy that sometimes they follow and sometimes they don't. That would have been the easiest thing to do, was to have her go up and do a message and say, hey, it's me. I'm fine. Happy Mother's Day. I'm still in recovery. I'm still recovering and look forward to being back, you know, on the trail, at your ribbon cuttings, at your garden openings right after Easter. They could have done that. They absolutely could have done that. But why they chose not to is, your guess is as good as mine.
So are you surprised by the amount of attention this has received?
No. And I think that every now and then you and I cover stories that, why are we talking about this? Why are we thinking about this? And typically it comes during a time when there's lots of continuous bad news. And we have been in a cycle of a lot of, not a lot of great news has been coming out, not in the country, not outside of the country. So when something like this comes along about a Photoshop picture, everybody can relate to it, no matter what socioeconomic group you come from. It doesn't matter who you are, where you work, where you live. Everybody understands photoshopping a picture. And you add that to the mystique of the royals. You add that to nobody seeing Kate since December. And you, Scott, have the perfect royal storm.
Alyssa Freeman with us, PR and pop culture expert, just sticking to the knitting. Alyssa, as always, so much fun. Have yourself a great day.
That's all for now.
Writing in the Globe and Mail yesterday, Campbell Clark says, if Chrystia Freeland and the federal government are looking for low-cost economic initiative, the answer lies within the office of Immigration Minister Mark Miller. The latest from Campbell Clark: want a low-cost economic initiative, fix the immigration mess. Campbell is with us now. Campbell, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. So what is the mess? What is the mess that you're speaking of? How will that help?
Yeah, there's something unusual that's happening in our immigration system now, and that is that there's been a large number, a huge bubble of temporary residents added to the Canadian population. It wasn't really planned. It was almost accidental in a way, and it's not part of the targets you see every year. You know, there's a target of 500,000 permanent residents next year, but we're talking about foreign students, temporary foreign workers, and there's just been a bubble. The population of Canada has grown faster than it's grown maybe ever. There's 1.2 million people added last year, 800,000 of them were temporary residents. And the thing is, usually immigration doesn't have that big of an immediate impact on the economy, but this is having an impact. And part of it has happened because the immigration system has been screwed up a bit, so we should fix it. One, we got to bring the numbers down temporarily, the number of temporary residents, because they're contributing to the housing shortage. The more people you have, and if you don't have enough houses, there's going to be a bigger housing crisis. And that gets in the way of bringing down inflation. And the other reason is that this has been a bubble of labor in the population. It makes labor cheaper, and it's discouraged businesses from investing in capital, which will bring down the growth rate if it's not changed. So there are some things, if we can fix the immigration system, that might have an economic impact, both in the sort of short, medium term, and it would improve growth over the long run.
As you mentioned, over 1.1 million come to Canada over the last year. You said that was not planned. The immigration department said a couple of years ago, you got to tap the brakes here. You're gonna cause a crisis in healthcare, or exaggerate the crisis in healthcare and housing, which it has done. How did it happen then, if it wasn't planned?
Well, that was almost a warning at the bottom of page 90 of a briefing that went through the PCO. So that was not a really hard warning to tap the brakes. What really happened here is the federal government keeps its eye on permanent residents. And then they have a bunch of programs that they more or less let control themselves. One was foreign students. Any student at a degree granting at an institution sort of approved by the provinces, they would get a visa to come to Canada. They not only get a visa to study, but they would, some of them, many of them in degree granting institutions, would get a postgraduate work permit for 3 years. So the people that were coming as foreign students would then also become temporary workers after. And they also opened up temporary foreign worker programs that became a little easier for people to come as temporary foreign worker programs. And part of the problem with that was not just that people were coming for those things, it's that it was made easier to become a permanent resident if you were a temporary resident. So there was a draw. Come to Canada if you came to Canada as a temporary resident, you had a good shot, or you could have a good shot of becoming a permanent resident. So that too was a problem because we punched a lot of holes in the system for selecting economic immigrants so that we could create special circumstances for truck drivers, for estheticians, for the types of people that industry groups wanted because they wanted to bring in workers for their industry. But that created a whole bunch of confusion. Now that's basically got to be fixed so that we have a more predictable system so that people are coming in smaller numbers temporarily and they're not using it as a way to get here permanently unless they have a real chance of getting here permanently as economic immigrants with good scores.
How did the post-pandemic situation affect all of this? CERB, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so the it wasn't so much the CERB that had an effect. It was the changing of the rules that had an effect. So the foreign students, for example, that had been going up even before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But what happened after the pandemic was, you might recall, well, first of all, there was nobody coming here in 2020 because of the pandemic. But then when the borders opened up, there was a labor shortage. People were talking about labor shortages. Business was saying, we don't have enough people. So they convinced the federal government to open up a bunch of new programs. Basically, each industry wanted a program for foreign workers for their industry.
Right.
And that created a whole hodgepodge system and then, you know, eased the temporary foreign worker rule. So there was this whole hodgepodge system that was created at the same time as the foreign students came back in bigger and bigger numbers. Mm-hmm. And we basically lost count. That's one of the amazing things is, you know, there was essentially a million people in Canada we didn't know were here until last year.
Yeah, it seemed, you're right, Campbell, it kind of snuck up on everybody. Like, how the heck did this happen? This is big government at its best and so on. How do you change that moving forward? How do you say all of a sudden, I'm going to start trimming some of the rules for immigration, I'm going to tighten things up a bit? And what's the response of Canadians to something like that?
Yeah, so look, there's always going to be pros and cons, but some of this is not that hard. First of all, the federal government has already put a cap on the number of new foreign students that will be accepted next year, so that number will gradually go down. And the federal government should also do more things about foreign students. For example, not every foreign student who comes to Canada for, say, a two-year college program should get a three-year postgraduate work diploma. So there's still some more things to do in that sphere. But the main thing that they really have to do is just take away all of those changes they made mostly post-pandemic, to provide special programs for every industry that wanted foreign workers and bring back the system to the kind of predictable system it was up until a few years ago. So really, the reforms aren't that, many of the reforms wouldn't be that complicated. They're just undoing the changes that were made in the last few years.
It seems when we have tried to fix a problem, we've created a couple more.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happened here. But maybe we tried to fix the wrong problem. In the wake of the pandemic, there was talk about labor shortages. We went overboard as a country in trying to fix labor shortages. Of course, industry is always going to complain they can't find workers. You know, they want to import labor. And that is something that we have to expect. But, you know, there's no reason the government has to intervene in labor markets every time an industry, you know, wants to have more foreign workers. We should have a more predictable system for permanent immigration. And, you know, there should have been some control on the numbers coming in as temporary residents because, you know, clearly there is a capacity that you can take at any 1 year for the number of people you want to add to your population.
Campbell Clark with us, chief political writer for The Globe and Mail, and his latest from yesterday, won a low-cost economic initiative, fix the immigration mess, Campbell Clark. Campbell, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You too.
Couple of airline stories going around, which makes us want to bring in Keith Mackey of Mackey International. He is with us now. Keith, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am, Scott, and I hope you are also.
So first of all, thank you so much, Keith. Let's start with the latest story we're hearing about turbulence in a large aircraft that I guess dropped about 150 meters, all within a very split second, and everything else that wasn't tied down went to the roof. Talk about this. What happened, and from where you see it, the effects of it?
Well, it's a typical case of a clear air turbulence. It doesn't happen very often, but when it does, the results are quite similar. That's why we always urge everybody, while you're seated, please keep your seatbelt fastened. No one that was strapped in with their belt was injured, only the ones that were just sitting in their seat or moving about the cabin. So don't stand up any more than you have to, and be sure you tie yourself down when you're in your seat.
What is clean air turbulence? So is this turbulence, which obviously is invisible to the pilots? It's not like a weather front you see coming in?
Correct. It's clear air turbulence, and you can't really detect it normally. It can be a juncture where two bodies of air are moving in different directions. It happens rather frequently, but not to that extent. Usually it just produces a bump or a rough ride for a little bit. But of course, under severe conditions, you can have these things as you experienced on this flight the other day out of in South America.
Would they have had any indication, the pilots, that they were heading into this?
I doubt it. Probably it was a beautiful day, just clear air, unless there was a flight before them that could have reported it. And on that route from Sydney to Auckland, there are not that many flights. So they probably just happened to stumble upon and found it all by themselves.
So obviously we know what happens in the passenger compartment. If you're not tied down in the flight attendants and such, my goodness, every time they're walking around, they're in a dangerous situation. But what happens in the cockpit when something like this happens, Keith? You said it's a surprise. It must, you know, for a split second, scare the bejeebers out of the pilots. What happens in the cockpit?
Well, as the airplane's descending, the speed is probably increasing. So you'd probably want to pull the throttles back to make sure that you didn't overspeed the airplane if it was descending nose down like that. Otherwise, if it were just descending in a vertical column of air, there might not have been any noticeable difference in speed. But basically, you just hang on, and it generally doesn't last very long.
Does it kind of like a wave just spit you out the other end?
Kind of like a bump in the road, if you will, a major bump in the road or a pothole.
And does you were talking about nose down, whatever, does the plane just go straight down, or does the nose or one part of the plane go down first, or is it just a drop everything straight down like an elevator?
Well, that's generally what it is. It just, the entire airplane descends rather rapidly, kind of like running off over a bump, and usually about 150 meters is the limit of your deviation from your flight path. And of course, you just don't want to be near any other aircraft out there. There's not much danger of that. And then it's a matter of analyzing any damage done.
And how do the pilots regain control? Or does the air just, again, you just, as you put it, you cross to the other side of the bump?
Yeah, you never really lose control. It's just that you're in a rapidly descending or sometimes rising column of air.
How often did you ever have that happen, Keith?
Oh, I've had it happen a number of times, but I've never had it happen to that degree of severity. It's unusual to have that noticeable a change where you're actually pinning people on the top of the cabin. That's a little surprising. It's a pretty rough hit. Apparently, some of the panels are even damaged with some wiring showing through. So I'm not sure the airplane was able to continue to Chile after it arrived in Auckland, because they probably have to do an assessment of any unseen damage.
Wow. And of course, the message here, stay seated and keep your seatbelt on. All right. What happens if you're mid-flight and a woman gives birth? What's the protocol?
Well, you ask her the name. No, generally, if something like this is going to happen, they made an announcement and apparently located a couple of doctors that were able to deliver the baby. But let me tell you what normally happens in the event of a medical emergency. Many airlines, although not all airlines, and I don't know whether Air Canada does or not, subscribe to a medical service, and the aircraft is equipped with more than the normal amount of emergency equipment. There's a lot of extra medication and medical equipment on board. The flight attendants receive extra training. And if you have a medical emergency, for example, if someone had a stroke or a heart attack, the flight attendants would immediately notify the cockpit, and they would be able to contact this company by a low-frequency radio and get a doctor on the line that was capable to talk the flight crew into what to do.
Wow.
And they'd be able to analyze the situation. And then the doctor would make a recommendation on whether or not the airplane should land. If they did have to land at an unusual place, for example, crossing the South Atlantic or something like that, the medical service would advise on a hospital. They'd notify the hospital of what was happening, and they'd arrange for an ambulance to be waiting as soon as the airplane landed. And if the situation were not that serious, where a landing wasn't necessary, they continue to monitor the situation, and it's an excellent system.
Wow. So therefore, the pilot wouldn't have to make the call. If your airline doesn't subscribe to that, would it just be between the pilot to, you know, assess the situation and determine if he has to land or she has to land or not?
Well, exactly. And they don't have any particular level of knowledge of emergency situations, nor do the flight attendants. So I guess they did the safest thing under the circumstance, although I don't think it was necessary to land in Bermuda. Air Canada does serve Bermuda, so they could get some ground handling done properly, but there's a couple-hour delay by the time you land and get another clearance to depart, and the reality is it looks like it was just a normal childbirth.
Keith McKay or Keith Mackey with us, Mackey International. Lots of airline stories of late, and Keith decoding it all for us. Keith, thanks so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You're welcome, Scott. You too.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Boy, you know, it's amazing how things have changed. And I always love talking to all the pollsters and getting different opinions of where Canadians' heads are at and what they're thinking. And over the course of the last 4 years, which encompassed the global pandemic, boy, our attitudes have really changed. About 63% of Canadians would prefer to see lower spending in the Prime Minister's budget, which is coming up, according to the poll by Nanos Research for Bloomberg. 38% of respondents want the money to go towards repaying government debt. 25% want actual tax cuts. Nick Nanos with us, Chief Data Scientist, founder of Nanos Research, and here now. Nick, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm fine, and great to join you and all your listeners.
So, Nick, how has this changed, say, from pre-pandemic days?
Well, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, the thing is that people always want government to kind of be on budget and to control spending. You know, actually, during the pandemic was the one time when Canadians were okay with ramping up deficits and spending more money because they knew that people needed help to get through the pandemic. But fast forward now, and it's pretty clear that Canadians would like to see government belt tightening and either to help pay down the debt or basically outright to help help cut taxes. I think a lot of this has to do with, you know, people struggling to pay for the groceries and struggling to pay for housing. And as a result, they want to see restraint and belt tightening from the federal government.
Is this usually a priority for Canadians?
Yeah, well, it usually is a priority. But my sense right now is because of the economic anxiety out there, because of the rising cost of living, that there's probably even a greater appetite right now. Because if Canadians are tightening their belt, they're probably hoping and expecting or the government to tighten its belt too.
So not only do they want spending cut, there's a large portion that want it actually put towards the debt.
Yeah, about 25%. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, for Canadians, you know, they know that there's a debt bomb or whatever you want to call it going on right now, and that we have to make sure that that stays under control so that it's not a burden for future generations.
So who do we blame for this, Nick? I mean, even a portion in the survey will blame business rather than government for this.
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the deficit, people will focus on the government. And I think that's why, you know, this upcoming budget that's due to be rolled out later this spring. Is it spring? Kind of. I don't know. It snowed the other day. But anyways, that's a different chat, right?
So how do they manage this budget? Because usually with budgets come lots of, you know, Christmas presents, bonbons, that sort of thing. How do you balance this all now and make it look like you're doing something without spending?
I think that's going to be the tricky part for the Liberals, because, you know, the other thing that we know is that there will be an election sometime, either later 2024 or potentially and likely in 2025. Usually budgets are before an election are kind of bigger spending. They have goodies and want to, you know, kind of what I'll say, spend in order to seem more appealing. The big question is what's clear is that two out of every three Canadians don't want to see more spending in this budget. They actually want to see restraint. And I think this is where the Liberals are going to be politically, at least, between a rock and the hard place. On the one hand, trying to put some new things in the window in order to make themselves a little more politically appealing. And on the other hand, reconciling kind of the difficult fiscal and financial position that the country's in right now.
Any sort of clue, Nick, as to which way you think government will go on this? Because there's a lot of balls in the air here.
Well, here's this. If we see a budget of restraint, that means there won't be an election, or at least the Liberals will not want an election in 2024. If we see a big spending budget with lots of new announcements, I would expect that the Liberals think that the election is probably going to happen in the next 6 months or perhaps in the fall. So I think this will be a big indicator as to whether we will be going to see an election campaign in 2024 or 2025.
A couple of the big questions before all that happens is, will the Liberals continue with their current leader, and will they touch the carbon tax? Thoughts on those?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, the thing is that right now the Liberals significantly trail the Conservatives, who are in the driver's seat. And Pierre Poilievre is more likely to be favored as the preferred prime minister over Justin Trudeau. You know, the thing is my sense is that I don't see a scenario where Liberals force Justin Trudeau out. I think the Trudeau brand is too closely linked to the party between him and his father. Whether he decides that he wants to stay as prime minister is a completely different thing. So I can't see a leadership change unless Justin Trudeau actually wants to retire from politics.
The PharmaCare plan, dental care, did that make a dent at all?
Nothing. Zip, diddly squat. You know, the thing is we didn't see with the big announcement about PharmaCare, based on the parliamentary arrangement between the New Democrats and the Liberals, you would expect with a big announcement like that, a pretty major initiative, that the numbers would change or help the Liberals. What we've seen, at least, is that there's been no material or major impact positively for the Liberals or the New Democrats coming out of the PharmaCare announcement.
And if the majority of Canadians want to see lower spending, that's not going to be on the same page, is it?
No, for sure. And I think this is where someone like Pierre Poilievre, who has been talking about, you know, the rising cost of living and has been talking about smaller, leaner government, probably resonates a lot with a lot of Canadians who are penny pinching right now, and they want to see the government penny pinch.
Nick Nanos, Chief Data Scientist, founder of Nanos Research. Nick, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
AutoCate is a newly launched membership-based platform geared towards women, aims to reduce fraud and discrimination in the auto repair industry. The platform, created by Stephanie Bruinsma, a mechanic and engineer grad from the University of Waterloo, connects people in need of car repairs or advice with trusted experts and educators. Stephanie Bruinsma with us, CEO and founder of AutoCate, and here now. Stephanie, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hi, Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me today.
So, Stephanie, give us a little bit of history here. How did this come about? How did you decide to start this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the best way to describe it is like it started with my sisters. So I have six wonderful sisters, none of whom are mechanic. I started in the trade or working and wrenching when I was about 15 and didn't really know what I was doing. And then after I got licensed and when my sisters, they constantly ran into a problem where they'd go to take their vehicle to the garage or wherever they were going. And they had all of these questions or they were really not understanding, hey, do I need this service? I don't understand why they're trying to sell me this. And so they would call me, right? Because they have a sister who's a mechanic.
So go ahead.
The idea is like, how do we scale that? How do we make sure that everyone has a big sister mechanic that they can call?
That's a great idea. Is this about understanding the work and what is being done or what your options are, or just trying not to get ripped off, just looking for a fair deal?
Honestly, the industry, like, so it's a little bit of everything. But like the auto repair industry from both the mechanic side and consumer side, like there's this old adage that nobody trusts mechanics. Good mechanics are hard to come by. And similarly, good mechanics finding good customers. So it is about solving that problem. You understand when you say yes to a brake repair that you know what you're getting.
So education, education, education.
Yeah.
Are mechanics, auto dealers, anybody who does repair work missing out on this?
Mechanics who like, so that, so mechanics love this. So I spoke with a mechanic that I used to work with who since run their own garage, right? And they try really hard to build trust with their customer. And so they'll take, if they do a brake job, right? At the end of the day, you pick up your car, they're going to show you the parts that they took off. You see, this is why I replaced it. Here you go. And that offers a lot of validity for people. But when people get charged, you know, $2,000 for a rear main seal, which is literally just like a rubber, it looks like a rubber O-ring.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of, it doesn't matter. It like, it brings up other bad feelings for them because they're like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And so a mechanic can then say, you know what? Go talk to AutoCate. She will let you know why this job costs that much. So it's building trust throughout the industry.
Is this specifically geared to just women?
It was developed and targeted for women, but no, it's available to everyone. We recognize that car owners and consumers, like the statistics will scare you in terms of like 27% of repairs are what we call upsells. So services you don't actually require. And that came out of an independent research. And then there's actually rampant underselling. That's, you know, when you go to the garage and this is your problem and you keep having to go back for the same problem.
What is the biggest challenge from a mechanic standpoint? I remember hearing an old ad line, and I think this was like for a clothing manufacturer, but it was an educated consumer is our best customer. Is that what's missing here? Is the disconnect between the customer and the mechanic?
That's what we believe. It's when you can, as a consumer, can understand that the mechanic is selling you a repair that you actually need and that you can, like with that authority as the consumer, say, yes, absolutely, I want that fixed. Or no, I don't want that fixed if it's more of a cosmetic type issue. It's kind of putting the power back on the customer. And mechanics inherently, like, you know, I went to trade school. Talking with the customers is not something we're taught.
Interesting. So how does this work? How does this all come together? How do you help the customer?
Yeah, absolutely. So for that, like the combination of AutoCate and what we have on their underlying. So there's tech and there's auto, and our auto comes from our fundamental team. So that's like our technicians, right? Our experts in the area. And then we have the tech side of things. That's the portal. So a customer would get in through the portal, and depending on what their issue is, it's somewhat of a triage, not all that different to that medical platform. That the name escapes me, right? Like, do you need to go to the ER right now?
Right.
Or
yep,
do you
yep.
need, yeah, that kind of idea. So they deal with the platform and then they get connected to the mechanic if required or a variety of other options, depending on what the issue is.
What's the response been like to this? Because it's certainly a different way of doing it.
The response has been so great, especially when we deal specifically with our target market. Like every woman I know has a very harsh story relating to this trade, myself included, and the other mechanics, Emily and Mary on my team. Absolutely, we've all dealt with this. And so it is just like an immediate somebody I can talk to, somebody that understands and like won't make me feel silly for asking questions. Or if I can say, you know, I don't understand that word you just said, we have no problem and be like, yeah, absolutely. Let's take it down.
Does the impression or the thoughts of the mechanic, whether whatever gender, does that change once, whether it's a male or female customer, displays that they at least know something about the industry? At least they know something about what they're talking about.
Yeah, it changes. And it is, well, I want to make sure I'm answering the right question. Are you asking about the gender research that we found or regardless of it?
I'm going to both eventually.
Okay, well, I will give you my answer and then you can navigate from there. And so there was a research study done with two groups of participants, and within each group, so the participants were divided up into knowledge about cars, not knowledge about cars. And within those two groups, there was male and female participants. And what they found is the women in the group that didn't know anything about cars were charged and quoted up to 30% more on the same repairs. But in the other category, those women who did acknowledge or give indication that they knew about the industry, they were charged the same as the men.
So the assumption is that women know less about cars than guys do, even though guys probably don't know that much about cars anymore either.
Unfortunately. And I mean, we're not blaming any, but less than 5% of mechanics are women. And that number is not changing.
Advice for women wanting to get into this industry.
Contact AutoKate. We have a very supportive team. If you want to be in this industry, we want to help you. It is a very rewarding career. I love fixing cars. My two mechanics, Emily, Mary, they love fixing cars. It's not about that. The industry is tough. So having other women who can understand what it's like specifically for that gender is really important. But you will get a fulfilling career and you will get to be on your feet all the day. So, you know, steps in and a garage door up on a beautiful day like today.
And advice for a customer looking for a good mechanic.
Always go with a mechanic who is willing and eager to answer your questions. Even if that is, hey, I want you to send me a picture or explain it to me. Or like at the end of the day, I'd like to take my parts home with me, that kind of thing. Like there is some scrap metal value to that, but they should at the very least be willing to show you kind of what they're doing, snap a couple pictures. We all have cell phones now. A mechanic who is interested in giving you the best service is going to want to help you understand the cost of the repairs and what the work that was done.
Stephanie Bruinsma with us, CEO and founder of AutoKate, a newly launched membership-based platform geared towards women, aims to reduce fraud and discrimination in the auto repair industry. Sounds like it's a home run, Stephanie. Thanks for the time. Good luck.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Money for nothing. It seems that with the CBC, I don't know how this is going to fly when we seem to have a CBC president that's out of touch, who even gets questioned by the CBC themselves as how they can administer bonuses while people are getting laid off. And they're continually asking for more money for the CBC. Now the CBC, we find out, has given out $14.9 million in bonuses last year, according to Access to Information records obtained by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. To talk more about all of this and where we go now, Franco Terrazano, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director here. Franco, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
It's amazing, Franco, that the CBC does more to kill its cause than anyone does. I can't believe this.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, no matter where you like stand on the public, the state broadcaster, the CBC, I think everyone is against this. I haven't really seen anyone say they actually support the fact that the CBC just handed out $15 million in bonuses, taxpayer funded bonuses, in 2023. And even that's really just the tip of the iceberg, right? Like going back to 2015, the CBC has handed out $114 million in bonuses paid for by the taxpayer. And like, let's just think of the context of these $15 million in bonuses that happened in 2023. Well, number one, you have the CBC president and CEO, Catherine Tate, crying poor, claiming the cupboards are bare, begging the government for more taxpayer cash. She even said the CBC is chronically underfunded at a committee hearing. Well, folks, like the CBC is getting more than $1 billion from taxpayers every year. The Fed's just threw another $96 million at the CBC. So in what world, like in what world is an organization chronically underfunded yet still has enough money to shower out $15 million in bonuses?
Franco, we've obviously talked about this millions of times, it appears. What constitutes a bonus for the government? And you've said many times just showing up, evidently.
Yeah.
But now, again, especially with the situation regarding the CBC president and the interview on CBC TV, how does this change the discussion? Because they're constantly, as you said, asking for money. They're constantly crying poor. And now this through Freedom of Information Act, the question's answered. I don't know if the CBC reporter ever found out, but in fact, they did give out bonuses. Does this change the discussion? Are people like again, I'm just thinking people are going to be more angry at the CBC now than ever.
Well, and we should be. And we should be, right? The fact that you claim that you're chronically underfunded, but have somehow enough money to hand out $15 million in bonuses. Yeah, people should be ticked off. And, you know, we kind of joked about it. What do you have to do to get a bonus in the government? And I always say, what, show up twice to work with the shoes tied? But it looks like that's actually the case here at the CBC, okay? Because they handed out $15 million in bonuses to 1,143 CBC staffers in 2023, okay? 1,143 staffers, okay? Well, this is what Kate said at her committee appearance. She said something along the lines of bonus pay is a key part of the total compensation of our non-union staff of about 1,140 employees. Isn't that something? So it looks like among the management executive class, the non-unionized employees at the CBC, it sure looks like from that statement, essentially all of them are getting a bonus.
So what has been the response from Catherine Tate, president of the CBC, since this information that you've uncovered?
Well, from today, I haven't heard Tate say anything. But her response has been exactly the same throughout the last couple months where the heat has been on her. She has been refusing to not pay out bonuses to the executives. I mean, look, here's what Tate's compensation is. Annual compensation is a range between about $470,000 to $623,000. That includes salary, benefits, and bonus. So it looks like Tate has been unwilling to end the bonuses and the gravy train for CBC executives and managers. We also haven't heard much from the governing party, the Liberals, right? The finance minister, haven't heard her say much on this. Haven't heard the Canadian Heritage Minister, Pascal St. Ange, say much. But here's the thing, okay? So Freeland, her next budget is April the 16th. In her last budget, she said that she would find a bunch of savings in the Crown corporations. Well, I think the perfect and most obvious place to find savings in Crown corporations like CBC is just to end these taxpayer-funded bonuses.
Totally off topic. And my last question here, Franco, what do you think we're going to see in the budget? How are they going to balance this? I mean, I was talking to Nick Nanos, a survey, 63% of Canadians want them to tap the brakes, to stop spending money, to pay down debt and such. What's the budget going to be like, do you think?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that is a huge survey result that the vast majority of Canadians want the government to stop being so bloated and to actually cut spending. Unfortunately, look, I don't have a crystal ball. I hope I'm wrong, but I think they're going to keep increasing spending. And what are you going to see about that? Well, guess what? More borrowing, bigger debt means higher interest charges. All of the forecasts show that in this upcoming budget year, interest charges on the debt will likely be more than what the federal government sends to the provinces in health transfer.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? No wonder people want the government to clean up the mess.
That is something that certainly helps resonate things because we certainly know how people feel about healthcare in this country. Franco Terrazano with us, Canadian Taxpayers Federation Federal Director, uncovering that the CBC gave out $14.9 million in bonuses last year, despite laying off people and the handout for more. Franco, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Hey, thanks for having me on today.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
you know, I think if you ask most Canadians, they are concerned about what goes on the internet and want a certain amount of freedom, but also a certain amount of protection. A lot of it seems to be common sense. However, when anything involves the internet, it's very complicated. Bill C-63, the online harms bill, continues to be a point of contention. Has it? We all want to be safe, but is it going too far? And now author Margaret Atwood has weighed in online, saying the possibilities for revenge false accusations are so inviting. To talk more about all of this, Jeffrey Dvorkin with us, senior fellow Massey College, former director of journalism at the University of Toronto Scarborough, author of Trusting the News in a Digital Age. Jeff, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm fine, thanks. I hope you are too.
Jeff, how do you wade into this? How do you find the balance? I mean, most want, most think that some of the activity that goes on in the internet is uninviting, should be policed. Yet, on the other hand, there's freedoms here. But really, we don't know much about this. We don't know much of the details. Canadians really don't weigh too far into this. What are your thoughts on this? Is it gone too far? Is it gone far enough?
Well, I think it's so vague that it's dangerous in its present form.
Yeah.
It just allows for so much to be taken on by various governmental bodies that at a time when people are feeling a little nervous about, the government's here, how can I help you attitude? It's not very enticing or it actually is very concerning. I think one of the things that is clear is that if someone puts something out on the internet, there are at present laws against hate speech and threats of violence. The law is now at present able to handle that. Whether it does it in a timely manner is another question entirely. I think the law as it's presently constituted is actually in pretty good shape. To have a governmental body then decide what constitutes appropriate speech or inappropriate speech strikes me as being a little bit dangerous. I'm with Margaret Atwood on this. I don't think that there is a role necessarily for the government to do this. I think there is an obligation on the part of media organizations to police what is being spread on their websites. That, to me, seems to make more sense.
And I've heard some say, Jeff, that the laws do exist. It's just a case of enforcement. So does this help or hurt? Because at first blush, it sounds good, but it has to work. It has to be efficient in all aspects here. Does this help or hurt, do you think?
I think the devil's in the details. And I think that until we have a better sense of what is actually being proposed, because right now it's so vague and nebulous, and it's sort of all things to all people, it needs more cooperation from media organizations, from civil liberties associations, and the occasional expert. I'm not looking for work, but I promise you. But I think that there needs to be a further discussion about what is needed right now. I know that when I was teaching at U of T, I was told that young men are kind of addicted to the worst aspects of what's on the internet. And I had a delegation of women in one class come to me and say, "What's the matter with the guys here?" I said, "Well, what do you mean?" They said, "They are addicted to pornography and that they spend a lot of time online, and it kind of poisons how they deal with the women in the class." And I thought, well, that's really actually a sad and very important aspect of what is available on the internet. To ban pornography strikes me as being maybe the wrong approach, but there's certain kinds of pornography that maybe should be prohibited. But who gets to decide that? That becomes the problem.
Is porn the issue here, Jeff?
I think it's part of the issue. I think that it's an issue that is pretty much out there among young people, but we don't want to really talk about it because I think that it goes into areas that we're frankly embarrassed to deal with. but that we may be forced to deal with it, especially in an era of artificial intelligence. AI is already starting to take images of people who are in the public eye and deforming them in certain ways. And I think that this becomes part of the issue. We've got the Americans have an election coming up. There's already fake imagery that's out there. It's not necessarily pornographic, although it's a bit weird. For example, of Donald Trump being surrounded by a lot of African-American young men. And the implication is he's a friend of African-Americans. Well, maybe that's true and maybe it's not true, but certainly the image that's being put out there is not true. And I think that we need to figure out a way in which we as a society can handle this imagery. It's actually, I think it's getting worse, not better.
Many would agree with that, Jeff. But what's next after this? This seems that this is all froth, more government and less result.
I don't know is the short answer. I wish I had an answer. And if I did, I'd be a wealthy person. But I think that what has to happen now is that government at various levels and leaders in our communities, wherever they are, need to address this. I think doing this in the media on the part of the citizens might be a good way to start. A conversation needs to be launched at this point.
Jeffrey Dvorkin with us, senior fellow, Massey College, former director of journalism at the University of Toronto Scarborough, author of Trusting the News in a Digital Age, speaking about Bill C-63. Jeff, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
My pleasure. Bye.
Ward 2 Councillor Cameron Cretch is being investigated by the Ontario Civilian Police Commission for motions he made at the City Council regarding police budgeting and his comments regarding how the Police Services Board reviews the annual budget. Let's bring in Peter Grabb to talk about this, professor of political science, McMaster University. He is here now. Peter, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, thanks. Hope you're well, too.
So, Peter, thanks so much. So, Peter, obviously, the Ward 2 councillor removed from the board, and well, this investigation goes on, so no direct involvement. What is the objective of the Police Services Board? What do they do? What are they charged with?
They play a really important role of providing a degree of civilian oversight over the police service. So they have an important role in being able to ultimately ask questions of the police chief in terms of, they can't oversee the direct operations of the Police Services Board, but are meant to bring public concerns over the discharge of the police's activities in the community. They also play a role of acting as a belt on budget issues between, the City Council, which ultimately imposes taxes on the residents of the municipality, and the police service, who produce their own budget. So, they have an important role of taking the police and ensuring that there's a degree of civilian oversight over the organization and delivery of police services in the city.
Obviously, there's debate whenever this this time of year rolls around with budgets and police budgets and such, and back and forth they go. That's part of the discussion, the negotiation. What did the councillor do that was out of line?
Well, I guess we'll have to see what the specifics are. I mean, he's received a letter, but, is keeping it confidential as he's been asked to do that. It would seem that the main points of contention are that the councillor moved motions about the police budget at the city council level. And so in a way was acting, at two different levels and probably was not discharging, in their view, the duty to respect the decisions made at the level of the Police Services Board. There's also, I think, a question of a number of public statements that the councillor made in the media while this was going on. Presumably, these were felt to run counter to some of the parts of the code of conduct in terms of, they shouldn't engage in, conduct that would discredit or compromise the integrity of the board of the Police Services Board. So presumably, some of his comments were felt to, bring this Police Service Board into disrepute, or alternatively, that he was making comments and it wasn't clear that he was making them on his own account, and not speaking for the police services board. But those seem to be the nature of the complaints that are likely to be being investigated in this case.
So all things considered, is this warranted then, in your opinion?
Well, I guess we'll have to see what the board comes up with. It's kind of hard really to see these as, you know, situations, at least on the face of them, that should, you know, produce this kind of result. I mean, clearly the counselor was much more active than past members of the police services board in trying to, you know, push for a further consideration of the police budget. But, you know, to the extent that we expect our elected representatives to be asking questions in these moments, that all these things were done in public and, you know, ultimately following the general rules that we'd expect, you know, in city council in terms of budgetary deliberations and at the level of the police services board, it does seem to, you know, be almost a bit of a chilling move rather than one that really is dealing with some, you know, serious problems. You know, I don't really think this is a situation where the police services board or the police service itself get pulled into disrepute because you have a counselor asking questions about the budget.
The counselor says because he's asking questions that now he's been silenced. Is that an overreaction? Is this about being active on a file, or is it about going beyond? It's about not following protocol.
I mean, in a way, following protocol is what silenced him in this instance. You know, when an inquiry such as this is launched, you know, under the code of conduct, the member of the police services board has to, you know, recuse themselves from playing their role. And so in that way, yes, he's been silenced. So I think, you know, the question comes back to ultimately, is it good for the governance of the police services board and by extension, its governance of relationships with the police in the city to be, you know, launching investigations in situations like this, where it seems kind of marginal that there's been, you know, a significant breach of the code of conduct. So, yeah, I mean, is it silencing? Yes, it is silencing. Is it deliberately done because the board doesn't want the counselor there? Not necessarily. Does it seem to be a decision to go forward with this inquiry that's, you know, marginal and maybe based more on a dislike of the position that the counselor is bringing to the services board? Quite possibly. I mean, certainly some of the issues that the board has seems to be citing in this case in terms of decisions made at the level of city council probably could also be applied to the mayor of the city, but wasn't. And so, you know, there are questions about whether there's sort of a singling out of the counselor in this instance.
Obviously, accountability is one thing, and obviously that's why we put people in city council, is to you know, make sure the city is accountable and such. And accountability is one thing, but is it the approach? Rather than finding solutions, this appeared more to be grandstanding or extreme driven. Is the approach really what the problem is here?
Well, I mean, I think, yes, there's a way in which the counselor...
In other words, talking about it on social media and sort of taking the attitude that he did was probably not the way to go.
Yeah, but ultimately, you know, attitude is attitude. The rules are the rules.
Yeah.
A counselor, probably in most cities, the police service is very popular. So a counselor who would ask questions about it would pay a price. You know, the fact that we have a counselor that's, you know, pushing this seems to be an indication that there's a sense in the city, maybe a minority one, but one stronger than normal, that there's an issue with the police budget that needs to be addressed. And, you know, there's the approach of trying to silence that or quiet it up by questioning the counselor based on his approach. It would seem to be another one for a police services board to say, well, the way to deal with this question is actually to talk about it and see whether there's something there, and play that role of ultimately mediating between the police service and feelings within the broader community to potentially restore the legitimacy of the police service, which presumably is a bit under question if you have politicians who are willing to raise these questions, which are usually electorally unpopular.
Peter Grant with us, professor of political science, McMaster University, and discussing the Police Services Board, what their objective is and how you go about it. Peter, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
And you too.
All right. Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, I hope you're doing well.
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I understand you want to talk about Chrystia Freeland.
Well, I saw this clip of her, and I think it's from today. But it's very short, and I realize that I think this is a sign that even those at the highest levels of the Liberal Party have thrown in the towel on winning any seats in the prairies. She was at some event, and again, I think this was from today, and her quote was, "For prairie people, the real-life version of dying and going to heaven is to move to B.C."
I saw this earlier today on X, and I was just trying to capture it and send it to Ben so he could play it. But yeah, I don't get it.
Like, I don't understand. Would be like walking into Quebec and saying, you know what everyone in Quebec dreams about? Not having to speak that stupid French. I mean, it would be like, you've essentially taken everybody who lives from west of Ontario through to the border of BC and said, we hate you, and I'm going to remind you of how much we hate you. Now, I mean, it's not like they were going to win a lot of seats in Alberta or Saskatchewan anyway. But you got to know that every person who was signing up to be a Liberal candidate in the Prairie provinces is like, Chrystia, really? Like, what am I going to be doing when I go to run? Like, what are you doing to me here?
Well, I've heard many say that, you know, the Prime Minister just doesn't care anymore. There's nothing he can do that works out. It all ends up sort of in the trash. And it's just, you know, with even the trips and flying away and the illusion that it, you know, creates for other Canadians and such, it's just got to the point where, yeah, whatever. Who cares?
But it's just so, like, the point is, it's so unnecessary. Like, I think she was trying to make a funny to the people in BC, endear herself to the people in BC. But she does understand we have this thing now called the interwebs, where stuff you say gets posted and people elsewhere can see it. Like, it just, it's not like there was some point she was making here that might be controversial or that you were on one side or the other. It was just an unnecessary error. I can only think of it as an error that now, as I say, all those people who decide they want to run for the Liberals in the prairies are surely saying, why am I going to waste my time?
It's interesting, too, because there's a budget coming up, and 63% of Canadians, according to Nanos, say they want the government to tap the brakes, stop spending so much money, and pay down the debt. So it's going to be quite a tightrope walk for them to somehow give us something to be happy about, all while doing what they really should be doing.
Well, especially, so it's this budget, she can probably get away with doing something like that. I don't know if she will. But remember, when we get into 2025 and we have an election looming, what does every government in power do leading up to an election?
Yeah, spend money.
It flings it around left, right, and center. So do you really believe that with the polls not looking good for them right now, what they're going to do leading up to a budget is tighten the belt and not hand out goodies? Nope, no party does that.
You know, I spent 3 years living in Calgary from 86 through 89. And, you know, I remember meeting Mayor Ralph Klein at the time, calling me an Eastern scum and pig and all that stuff with a laugh on his, with a smile on his face and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, for years and years and years and years, the prairies have constantly complained that nobody in the East pays attention to what they're doing. When Danielle Smith was on Chorus Radio in Calgary, we used to do a simulcast show and she was banging the drum. Why don't you people listen? Why don't you listen? And I have heard more stuff about Alberta in the last couple of years because our government that used to be center left has now gone to the extreme left. They're constantly talking about Alberta. I have never in my life heard so much attention paid to Alberta until Danielle Smith became the premier. And obviously the prime minister has taken the party to the extreme left. It's like we're talking about Alberta every day. We never even used to mention their name.
There is,
it's a target to point at, like Trump. Well, look at them. They're stupid. They're not like us.
Yeah, and I, again, I mean, you look at the I don't think it was the last election, the one before it was, where was it not the one before where there was no Liberal seats in Alberta or Saskatchewan? I think there was like one maybe that popped up in Saskatchewan this last time. But it does become a thing that I think is worth following, because especially because the last time Alberta was this furious about everything, the other Trudeau was in power. Then his son comes along and things had been seemingly in this country going reasonably swimmingly. We were kind of all getting along. Quebec was mostly mollified and, you know, it's been a while since there was a move for separatism and everything else. Things looked like we were kind of, you know, we have disagreements, but nobody was really feeling bent out of shape. And now the second Trudeau comes along and repeats the history of his father, and now the West is feeling completely ostracized. You've got Guibo saying stuff that is making them furious every single day on stuff. Like it's almost like they sit in a room and they go, all right, what are we going to do to needle Alberta and Saskatchewan today? Because we're not getting any seats there. So let's tee off on them and use our, you know, it's like a comedian who's going to do a TV special, but goes to the clubs first to try out his material to make sure it works. Let's try out our stuff on Alberta and see how it goes with the rest of the country.
It's like the Liberals coming up with a strategy. What do we do if Donald Trump becomes president? How do we handle this? No, really, the meeting was not about a strategy to deal with Donald Trump. It's how do we use Donald Trump to somehow benefit us in the next election? That's really what it's about. All right, that's it for us. Thank you, Scott. Have yourself a great show tonight.
I will, and I was going to give a line about, you know, what listeners to the Scott Thompson Show's dream, you know, was of heaven, but I can't come up with a good line, and they're all really nice people, so I'm not going to say anything.
Don't you worry about a thing, because as we're talking about this, and I have it written in front of me, I'm making it up as we go.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
I'm going to have the last word because it's my show. Liberal Minister Chrystia Freeland says, for prairie people, the real-life version of dying and going to heaven is a move to BC. For Canadian people, the real-life version of dying and going to heaven is an election so we can get rid of this government. Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.